and welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasures found within his pages. And now, on to the class. Well, guys, let's go ahead and get started. This is probably everybody's favorite topic in the church. It's certainly mine, you know. And to be quite frank, if there was some way to skip this thing, I probably would, except for the fact that it played such an important role in the early days of the church, and it still haunts us to this day, and it's still a function of what happened with Joseph Smith and what happened in Nauvoo. Brethren, this is especially a fun topic in Relief Society. This is their favorite topic as well. But let's go ahead. So I wanted to kind of give you some information on this. To be honest, you know, Cindy knows that I've been wrestling with this all week, because the more I read and the more I try to read firsthand accounts from people and what I can pull from so many sources is just a bummer. I'll be honest, man, it's a tough one, and yet it's there, it's us, it's part of us, and it's still one of those times where you say, you maintain. Somebody once said, "You got to have a really strong testimony to study our history," and that's true. And it's not. I think if we have a testimony that of Jesus Christ, we have a testimony of the gospel, we have a testimony of the saving ordinances of the gospel, then this is easy. If our testimony is based on leaders and the messiness of mortals making decisions and wrestling with certain things, and the church developing around the gospel and how the church administers the gospel, then I think it's tougher. And so we get a chance to say, I have a testimony of the church leaders. I see Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and those brethren as inspired, powerful leaders that inspire me to try and follow their example. And at the same time, I see their flaws and weaknesses, and I don't want to see them as any more than inspired mortal men and women doing the best they know how to do. And from that standpoint, it feels like they become emulatable. Our lives are messy. Our obedience goes up and down. We misunderstand things. We do it the best we can. And so did they. So if we can see it in that context, that helps. By the way, completely unrelated, I thought this was funny. Recent game show. Yeah, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Joan. okay. It's so close. Yeah. Okay. He's got it now. Okay, now we can go on. Okay. So I want to start with just kind of some quick facts. So we kind of frame this theme a little bit here. Number one, I found it interesting in my research, one of the things that I didn't necessarily know, is that LDS researchers are becoming more skeptical about the details of polygamy starting in Kirtland. We've always tended to put it in Kirtland with Fanny Alger and others. And at this point, as the researchers are digging in deeper, they're finding more questions than answers. We think certainly some elements of plural marriage, celestial marriage, were being revealed to Joseph in Kirtland. How that expressed itself with Fanny Alger, we don't know. Because for one thing, she never talked about it. She never wrote about it. Joseph never talked about it. Joseph never, we always got it second and third hand. And so what I'm seeing even in among LDS historians and church history historians who are working so hard on transparency, that they're just saying, we think it started in Nauvoo, not Kirtland. We can't explain everything about what was going on in Kirtland, but that moves it. And it certainly makes some sense, because what is more likely is that with better understanding of the sealing power coming in 1836 and the building of the temple, and Joseph sitting in Liberty Jail for 5 months and thinking and praying and understanding, that it makes more sense actually that he began the practice fully in Nauvoo in April 1841. Yeah.
Even that is now being really scrutinized.
Oh, yeah.
The affidavits are not what they
do. That's right. Yeah. Because, thanks, Jeff, because Joseph never spoke publicly on the practice. Yeah. And we have, so every document we have is decades after the fact. And by the witness of others, not Joseph. And you go, well, wait a minute. We had section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants given in 1843, right? When just quickly, and I'll show you some, I'm jumping way to the head, but just give you an idea. When was section 132 put in the Doctrine and Covenants? 1852. And I'll show you in just a minute the 1844 Doctrine and Covenants and what was in the place of section 132. Now, I'm going to say that because as we're going through this, I'm fully aware that one of the trends that's happening, especially in social media, is that there are a number of influencers that are out there pushing hard to say that are balancing two things. I love Joseph Smith and I hate polygamy. I love Joseph Smith and I hate polygamy. Therefore, what's a really good way to balance that dissonance? It was Brigham Young. Joseph never did it. I love Joseph. He never practiced polygamy. It's like we're going back to the Community of Christ days. So it was Brigham Young started it. It was Brigham Young's idea. And that is the thing that is being kind of pushed prominently at the moment.
I'm so glad they're not going to blame Abraham and Isaac.
Hold on to that. We're not far from that. We'll get into that in a second. Okay? Because they sort of did. Okay, so Joseph never speaks publicly on the practice. So I'm convinced in the last 2 to 3 years of his life, he's focused on two things. He knows his time is about up. He can feel that it's about, he might be gone soon. In the last 2 years of his life, he appears completely focused on, number one, creating eternal bonds, relationships, connections with himself, with his family, and those that he loved the most, with the saints. So he was so aware of wanting to create those links, but also aware, kind of in that literalist 1800s thinking, was that if we don't do it here, it won't happen in the eternities as much, unless we seal them quickly, because nothing really is going to happen there. So again, literally, like I've mentioned before, like Parley Pratt and others would be saying, if women are going to have increase kids in the future, in the celestial realms, it'll take them 9 months, you know, then they'll give birth, then they'll be, you know, and it's like literally thinking if we do it here, that's how we'll do it in the eternities. That's where a number of women outside the church are saying, I don't want to be an eternal womb. I don't want to be pregnant for the eternities, you know. and be morning sick every, you know, once a year. So Joseph was desperately trying to create connections and relationships to bound and tie and connect and seal and weld the families that he loved so much, particularly with the 12 and the people he was close to. And how do we do that? They were literally seeing that the altar sitting in the Nauvoo temple was the anvil of heaven. And at that anvil, we will be forging those links that will last for eternity. That's how we're going to do it. And if you don't get there, or if you're going to weld yourself to somebody who wasn't a member of the church, who left the church, now you're drifting for eternity. So you've got to be sealed to somebody that is active and believes, because there won't be another chance later on. It was a very literalist thinking. And the church will think that until the 1890s.
I think there's a lot of members of the church that still think
that. Isn't that true?
I don't know how many people that I've talked to that thought, well, my spouse isn't going to make it, so I'm out of luck.
We got divorced, and now our kids are spinning in space. You know, they're not welded or linked to anybody. They've somehow lost that ability. Okay, so we still have some of that literalist thinking. Okay, so that he wants to create eternal bonds and connections, and he sees in plural marriage the way that that is going to happen. And I'll show you how that plays out. But that also means that he's very, very aware that he's got to avoid the explosive reaction that's going to occur when the doctrine of plural marriage ever becomes public. And he wasn't kidding. So what we talked last week about Freemasonry was actually going to, one of the appeals for him about Freemasonry is that it would put people under a bond of secrecy and connection and brotherhood to one another. So Freemasonry, with all of the eternal structure and form that it brings, an additional understanding of things, it also is a way to help protect what's going on with the possibility of plural marriage getting out. Does that make sense? And he's right, because it doesn't stay under wraps more than about a year before it blows up on him. And it did play a role, as we know, in his death. Okay. Any comments on those? That make sense, sort of?
Well, I was thinking in the future then. The doctrine that we held of adoption,
yes,
kind of made lapped into the same thing. How are we going to create these relationships that we desire?
Yeah, and that's why, again, the temples did adoption. We're all going to adopt ourselves to Brigham Young or Joseph Smith or Heber C. Kimball until 1893, when I think it was John Taylor or Wilford Woodruff, who gets the revelation.
And he had his feeling resolved and redone for his family.
Yeah, to connect to his family, not to Brigham Young, or not to, you know. So, but that's what was starting to happen. You got to be sealed to a rising star. You don't want to be sealed to a schlump. That's not going to take you anywhere. Okay, all right. So that said, so what's going to happen here? And let me show you how this kind of plays out. We think on April 5th, the day before he dedicated did the groundbreaking on the Nauvoo Temple, that his first plural wife will be Louisa Beeman. Louisa is, and this gives you some idea of how the thinking on this thing goes. Louisa was married to a brother Beeman, and they lived in Missouri. And in 1839, when Far West falls, Beeman leaves the church, and he apostatizes and stays in Far West. Louisa, his wife, will basically divorce him. There wasn't a lot of traditional divorces as we see it these days. She divorces him. She goes to, with the saints, ends up in Nauvoo. But now she's married, but she's married to a non-member. And in Joseph's way of thinking, her eternities are in doubt. So the first person that he's then going to approach is going to be her and her brother, I think. Yeah, I think it's her brother. That he approaches the two of them together. They will then meet out in the woods, and she will be sealed to him for eternity. And we don't have, again, with all of these things, you never know. Was there some consummation of some of these marriages? Some there was, and most there wasn't.
Do we know if she was even sealed as a wife or as a sibling or as a...
She was sealed as a wife. She's his first.
Didn't Joseph give the sealing authority to her brother?
Yeah. And he's going to do the same thing to Dimrick Huntington for, and we'll talk about that, okay? But anyway, so he would then give them that power and they would do it. Louisa was then sealed to Joseph Smith as a wife.
What was his brother with? Performed
the marriage, was a witness and performed the marriage.
She was still legally married.
But remember legally in those terms, you know, again, she had divorced him. She'd said, I'm divorced from him, but they didn't have like a formal court thing where you go before the judge and he pounds the gavel and now in the court records it's now. Divorce in those days was, we are divorced, I'm out of here. And they were gone. So she had divorced him for all intents and purposes according to the laws of the time. So she's now going to be sealed, though, to Joseph Smith, and he's now saved her salvation. She is now exalted in a way that she wasn't going to be before.
So is she still married to her non-member husband in Nauvoo?
She was still legally married to Beeman, who's in Far West, but as far as they were concerned, that they were now divorced. So she marries Joseph at a time she's divorced, according to the laws.
How long have they been married?
She leaves in 1839, so this is 2 years.
So this is 1841?
This is 1841. Okay. This is the first one.
But I thought you said that she was married to a non-member.
She was. Well, he had been a member. He's now a non-member. He's been excommunicated. Yes, he's been excommunicated. He leaves the church, and now she's tied to a guy that was a member. He's now a non-member. So there's going to be no eternal marriage for her. So she's lost. Oh, I'm sorry. No, she didn't. No, she's going to leave Beeman. The only other person she will ever be married to is Joseph. Okay, yeah.
So it used to be, and I don't know if it's still is today, but if you're married in the temple and you get a civil divorce, you're still sealed.
That's right.
And the sealing, but really being sealed requires the Holy Spirit of promise. And so you can still be legally married and you can still be living as a marital community and go along path dumb and happy and not live in the gospel.
And the sealing is still in place.
You're only technically sealed, but you're not actually going to be sealed.
You know, part of the thing that's going to be fun about this, guys, is that we want to look at this whole thing through present eyes and settled church policy and handbook instructions. And they're doing it on the fly. This is like the first thing. And you're going to watch them change it and stuff like that over and over and over. Yeah. For her? No. No, because again, you have two problems here. One is we have to keep this secret. Two, Emma wasn't there. Emma doesn't know. Emma doesn't know. That's where one of the problems is going to lie here.
That's the big problem.
It's a huge problem. Yeah.
And three, she was later married to Brigham Young and had five children.
Yes, she did. Ultimately, after a lot of, I mean, in some ways, Brigham Young will be kind of the Leveret marriage of Israel. You know, it's like Eliza Snow, Zena Huntington, Louisa Beeman, all of these that had been Joseph Smith's wives. Now it's up to Brigham Young to take care of them, and they can just...
The other point, though, there is many of the wives that were attributed to Joseph Smith ended up being married to Brigham Young.
Yes.
And became part of the major group of people that gave affidavits to Joseph Smith practiced polygamy.
They were. And
she gave the affidavit all while they were married and raising young.
It's true. It's true. Although Eliza Snow, and I was almost going to put a picture up here. Anybody ever been to Brigham Young's grave in Salt Lake? It's about two blocks over from church office building. You go down the street and up the block and get the Brigham Young cemetery. Okay? So you got Brigham Young's grave here, and then right next to it is the grave of Eliza R. Snow Smith. Is right next to it. You know, she like, it isn't going to be Eliza R. Snow Young. It's going to be Eliza R. Snow Smith. She knew who she was married to.
So when did the Doctrine and Covenants, when was the revelation given that if it wasn't properly recorded, it didn't have ratification?
Section 128. So that's 1840.
So this marriage happening after...
Uh-huh.
It was clarified that if you do see something on earth, it's sealed in heaven. But if it's not properly recorded, it's nothing.
I know. Guys, I'm just saying, that's why I say that there's a messiness here that you need to be aware of. One is it's not being recorded. The other one is that Section 132 will pull on the idea of... If Abraham is going to receive a wife, additional wife for Sarah, then Sarah's got to give Hagar. These guys aren't being given by the other wife. I mean, like I say, they are working their way through this. This is messy. This is messy. But wait, there's more. It gets messier. How are we doing so far? Are we comfortable? Yeah, are we going to do this in gospel doctrine? Oh, heck no. Yeah?
Well, I'm obviously somewhat of a contrarian.
Oh, we need contrarians in this group besides Jim.
Section 101 or 102 that actually was in the Doctrine and Covenants, even at this time, that said one man, one woman.
Yeah, that... I'll show you that in a second. It's published, actually. It's in the 1844 Doctrine and Covenants, and it will be published 2 months before Joseph is killed. Now, I'll show it to you in just a second. Because that stayed in there until 1852 when that was taken out and Section 132 was dropped in Salt Lake.
So did that have the label of 132?
Just a second. What?
That was put in Joseph was still alive.
Yes. Yeah, the statement on marriage was put in while Joseph was still alive. It's still part of that. Remember, he's working really hard to say, we're not doing this. That's why the Nauvoo City Council is saying we're not doing this. The Relief Society is saying we're not doing this. Everybody's saying we're not doing this. And we're doing this. Because if this gets out, Joseph Smith might be killed and the saints might be expelled from Nauvoo, which it did. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if the old, if there was something in the slot of Section 132.
There was, statement on marriage.
So we have a section of the Doctrine and Covenants that is completely replaced by a different section.
Yes, in 1852. I'll show that to you in a sec. Okay? All right. Okay, now... I said it could get worse. It did get worse. Sarah Bates. Sarah Bates is married to Orson Pratt. Orson Pratt is on a mission to England. And shortly before Orson Pratt is going to come back from his mission, we're not sure exactly the timing on this, but But Orson Pratt is one of those brethren that Joseph loves and has kind of been through the ringer with him. He loves Orson Pratt. And one of those things then that says, I want to seal the Pratts to me so that you are part of my eternal family and receive your exaltation along with me. So I'm going to seal And so he's going to approach several women who are married to his apostles to be sealed to him, but in essence, it also seals their husband as well. So it's a sealing, it's not a marriage. I'm not going to be married to you technically as a wife, but I'm sealing you as a couple, basically. But the way to do it is I seal the wife. Okay? That's the thinking at the time. With Sarah Bates, that goes over like a lead balloon, as it will with Brigham Young, or with Sidney Rigdon's daughter, has the same reaction. Okay? Because there is some belief, not, I don't want to get it too far into the woods. I don't want to make this Jerry Springer like. Did I do it already?
I think we have to have a fist fight.
There's some belief that she's having an affair with John C. Bennett. And John C. Bennett is pitching the idea of spiritual wivery to her. So there's pretty good evidence that suggests they were doing stuff they shouldn't be doing. Okay? When Joseph approaches Sarah Bates, not only is she saying no, but she's upset about it. But when Orson Pratt rolls into town just a few months later in July 1841, guess who's going to tell him about the proposal? John C. Bennett. Do you know what Joseph said to your wife? Do you have any idea? What, really?
Yeah.
And then she's going to go, yeah, it was Joseph proposed to me, and it was, you know, and it feels to me, and I might be wrong, that they were kind of covering for each other. But to Orson Pratt, bless his heart, man, he rolls off of this mission where he's done incredible things in England, and he rolls in, and this is what he's now hearing. And he will struggle for days with this. Ultimately, he will side with Sarah. Ultimately, Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball are trying to keep this guy from suiciding. They find him on an island out in the middle of the Mississippi. And this is the wilderness and the most destructive moments of Orson Pratt's life, I think. I believe.
So did he know about John C. Bennett's relationship with his wife?
Not at first. No. All he knows is that she's saying that Joseph was hitting on me, and John C. Bennett is saying, yeah, he was hitting on your wife. And so now he goes through all of this. This was a real struggle, and it will take months. And ultimately, interesting thing for Orson Pratt is that he will then be excommunicated by Brigham Young for a period of a few months. Then they will come back, they will be rebaptized, and a few months after that, Joseph will move him back into the Quorum of the Twelve. But this period of time was a real struggle for Orson Pratt. Bless his heart, man. He was just... And ultimately, he will move... When he goes to Utah, Sarah Bates will divorce him. I mean, she will hang on forever to that. She's kind of covering her tracks, I think. Okay? But anyway... But this was the kind of thing that I'm talking about, is that that he's trying to seal couples, and he's kind of doing it sloppily. Emma doesn't know about this one. I don't know much about Lucinda Pendleton, but the Huntington sisters. This is an interesting one. Real quickly, and I don't want to go into so much detail because this is just hard stuff, right? Zena Huntington, bless her heart, he will approach her at the same time as he approaches Louisa Beeman. And she says no. Doesn't make sense to me, and I'll give you her quote in a sec. She says no. She marries Henry Jacobs. They get married. And then 6 months later, she will go, okay. So she will then be sealed to Joseph after she has married Henry Jacobs, and he kind of goes along with that. Because this is kind of saving us, and I understand this. Okay, so again, messy, right? But these are, but Emma will give her approval for the Huntington sisters, and then she will kind of withdraw that approval. Yeah. The second time,
yeah.
This time with Emma there.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's why I say this. You watch how messy this thing is.
So that's a renewal of a sealing ordinance.
Yes.
Just like we never do.
We never do that. Okay, so anyway, you'll just kind of see these. So if you kind of look through, you see again, Orson Hyde, Hiram Kimball, Henry Jacobs, who was a good guy. And you just see that, again, he's trying to seal these husbands and wives together by being sealed to the wife, yeah. Really good question. Did he have any children? I just saw about 5 years ago, the researchers that did some really hard, extensive DNA stuff, and they can't find any kids from any of these. Yeah. Yeah, and that's why you look at most of these, and of course, you know, those that are really kind of prying are wondering how many of these marriages were consummated. Not very many. Most of them, there weren't. This was sealings to couples, but understood as that line between marriage and sealing was really blurry at that time. So most of them were, they weren't. Now, Eliza Snow said yes, and Zena Huntington will say yes in their affidavits. A lot of this comes out in the Smoot hearings in 1912, when they're trying to admit Senator Smoot into the Senate and the church is on trial, and they will give affidavits to this. Yeah. Right. Yeah, nobody's.
The DNA research they did, they were able to actually track down people that actually claimed it. We do have DNA evidence of Joseph Smith's line, his wife, and his children.
Right. Yeah, so it's possible that they're out there, but they've never been able to find it, and they have worked really hard working with all of these guys and their kids and never been able to prove that. Yeah. No, they were pretty good. They were pretty fertile. She had, what, 9 kids? They just couldn't keep them. They certainly did, yeah. Yeah, okay. So, anyway, the only other one I want to mention on this list is Nancy Rigdon. She's the daughter of Sidney Rigdon. She doesn't take it well. And that causes a rift between he and Sidney, because she never would accept it. And did I put it in here? Oh, I did. Okay. This is a statement that Joseph wrote to the Rigdons, particularly to Nancy, trying to explain what it is that he was trying to do. And I'm going to quote it, and you're going to go, oh, we recognize that quote. This is one that we know really well. But it's one that is very, very familiar to us. It's just interesting that this was given in the context to Nancy. And it's this. Happiness is the object and desire of our existence. And we'll end up, therefore, if we pursue a path that leads to it. This path is virtue, righteousness, faithfulness. We cannot keep all the commandments without first knowing them. We cannot expect to know them all. That which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another into eternity. Our Heavenly Father is more liberal in His views and boundless in His mercies and blessings than we are ready to believe or receive. That comes from that revelation to Him, to her. Okay? All right. Enough messy. So one of the things I was thinking about in looking at all of this is, how did the individuals themselves respond when they first hear about the doctrine? And there's some great responses here from these guys. John Taylor. It was not so easy as one might think. When it was revealed to us, it looked like the last end of Mormonism. For a man to ask another woman to marry him required more self-confidence than we had. Yeah, I would think so. And then this famous quote from Brigham Young that you guys have heard before. My brethren know my feelings were at the time Joseph revealed the doctrine. I was not desirous of shrinking from any duty, nor failing in the least I was commanded. But it was the first time in my life that I ever desired the grave. And I could hardly get over it for a long time. When I saw a funeral, I felt to envy the corpse, its situation, and to regret I was not in the coffin.
Might have took him a long time to get over it, but he got over it.
Finally got over it. Yeah. Well, as we know, this was, in the long run, this was easier on the guys. The ones that my heart really grieves for is like my great-great-great-grandmother, what she went through in doing this, and then these wonderful sisters that just went through what they went through. Martha Brotherington, writing to Brigham Young. My feelings at that moment were indescribable. God only knows. What, thought I, are these men? And I thought, almost perfection itself. These men were perfect. Are they deceivers? Is all my fancied happiness but a dream? 'Twas even so, but my next thought was, what is the best way for me to act at this time? I can't even imagine the stretch of challenge to your faith and your belief that it hit for them. If I say no, they may do as they think proper, and to say yes, I never would. So I considered it best to ask for time to think and pray about it. I therefore said to Brigham Young, if it was lawful and right, perhaps I might, but you know, sir, it's not. Then she will pray about it, and she'll get some inspiration and guidance to go ahead and say yes.
Was there any United States law related to polygamy at that time?
At this moment, I think there was some anti-bigamy laws out there, but not many. But like we've said, when Abraham Lincoln runs, he runs on the twin pillars of evil, the twin pillars of something. Barbarism, the twin pillars of barbarism, which were slavery and polygamy. And that's one of those things I want to do as this is March.
This is 15 years before Lincoln ran for president.
And 20 years before Edmunds Tucker. We're going to talk about Edmunds Tucker. That's why I want to be able to get into some of the things we would never see in a gospel doctrine class. I want to finish up in Nauvoo and get us across the plains and get us into the Utah War and the polygamy years when everybody's going to prison and everybody's hiding out and the church is being disenfranchised, and just because it's our history. We just never get a chance to. If you didn't grow up in Utah and get in Utah history, you won't get it. So anyway, all right. So that's her response. Now, Zena Young, Zena D.H. Smith Young, her and her sister. When I heard that God had revealed the law of celestial marriage, that we would have the privilege of associating in family relationship in worlds to come. See, for her, she understood it that Celine and marriage, this was about the future, really. Worlds to come. I searched the scripture, and by humble prayer to my Heavenly Father, I obtained a testimony for myself that God required that order to be established in His church. I made a greater sacrifice than to give my life that I would never anticipate it again to be looked upon as an honorable woman. Whew. Let that one sink in a little bit. I'm going to do this. This is going to be known, and I'm never going to be seen again as an honorable woman. That's hard. By those I dearly loved. Why? Because we're going to keep it secret. It's not going to be known, and for people that aren't going to understand. How could I compromise conscience and lay aside the short testimony of the Spirit of God for the glory of this world? That, wow. Now, so how did they look at this? I think this is 1888, something like that. I think they were putting some depositions together. I think at the time that Edmund Tucker, which was the laws that have been passed against polygamy and that disenfranchised the church. And these sisters that had been sealed to Joseph Smith, this is Eliza Snow, and these sisters then come together in Utah, and they had like the sisterhood of those that have been sealed, and they saw themselves as sisters. Zena Huntington sends a letter to Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner, another of Joseph's wife, on June 27, 1886, on the anniversary of Joseph Smith's martyrdom. We remember this day of all days to us. I went to Sister Eliza's. We talked over our past a little, and Sister E spoke in tongues to comfort and cheer us. But how the veil was thinning as we advanced, I cannot tell you, but we feel the spirit of it. At 3 p.m., Sister Emily P. Young sent for Susan, and Sister Presidia were there to be administered to. We left her resting. I think this is when Presidia was almost dead. I wonder what Joseph will want next for her to go on with the work on the other land. Just so we're prepared, all right. I hope she will soon be restored. Isn't that amazing? We still feel in 1886 this connection to Joseph Smith, and we wonder what Joseph has planned for her next. Respond, how's that touch you? Or how's that affect you, if you think about that?
Certainly a high degree of testimony and faith.
Yeah.
Apparently don't rise quite that far.
Yeah. And for years not knowing. See, I think, for instance, I think about on the day that if you go to Nauvoo today, and you go to the Mansion House. On the day that Joseph and Hiram were killed, the day after, they're brought to the Mansion House, and the Mansion House was much bigger. There was a back wing going up the street that is not, the back end of the house is not there. But that's where Joseph and Hiram lie in state. And it said all of Nauvoo shows up, and they walk across the stoop. That is still there of the, and I think about it when I go to the Nauvoo house, that stone stoop is there. You step over the same threshold as did all of Nauvoo for the next couple of days to go file through and see Joseph's body, Joseph and Hiram's body lying there in state. As did Zena, as did Eliza, as did all of these women that had loved him and were sealed to him and really had to keep that grief in sacred silence. I think it's just, wow. My heart goes out to them, yeah.
I just find this shows their great love for each other.
Yeah, yeah, they saw each other as sisters who had gone through this period of time For sure. Yeah. You thinking?
No, I have.
Fire away.
Well, I just think there's so much comfort and there's so much distress that individuals have based on their understanding, and I'm using the word understanding, I really mean misunderstanding,
yeah,
of the doctrine and how things work. And we recognize how confused they were,
yeah,
including the apostles and the prophet. And I, for myself, I have to recognize that all of the things that I think that I understand,
yeah,
aren't all, they're not all going to be correct.
That's right.
And so when I see somebody else and I see, oh, they're really in distress over this misunderstanding, maybe they're not misunderstanding. Or on the other hand, they're getting great comfort from this misunderstanding. Is there any reason for me to correct them? What if they're right? Or even if I'm right, does it help? You know?
Boy, so I think that's a great comment. I think so, because especially as we're looking at the past, who's to say? I mean, by and large, we're going to say we have more light and knowledge than they did then. So by and large, we understand better, but also by and large, they're operating out of what they know with the knowledge that they have, with the understanding that they have, and they're acting based on that.
Can't help but throw in, when I studied some of this, Brigham Young's time, he actually granted divorces fairly easily.
Yeah.
Tell the women, if you're not happy with this,
yeah,
go ahead and get divorced.
Right.
And if you, you know, there, most of the higher church leaders had a dozen or more wives.
Yeah.
And look at the, you know, in genealogy history, it's logical. If that many wives, they, nearly all of them had more than one divorce. You know? And I remember reading one account that women got married and they said, spiritual, but in practice,
it's stunk.
It was pretty much like being a
single. Oh, yeah.
They saw the father and they
yeah. Yeah, in so many ways. That's why I'm trying to separate out a little bit from Nauvoo polygamy, which was we're not sure what we're doing. We're trying to figure out how to do it. How are we seeing it? From Utah polygamy, where we're going to announce in 1852, we're out of the closet. You know, this is what we're doing, and it's widely known, and here's how we're doing it, and so in so many ways, Utah polygamy is going to be an awful lot like the law of consecration was among the saints earlier. Sounds great in principle. On the ground, it stinks often. Just does, you know, when you're trying to take mortals that are trying to somehow flesh this thing out. It at times it was horrific. But that's why I think it's two different scenarios, and the abuses in under Utah polygamy were far worse than this. Yeah.
A modern day polygamist had been, you know, he had like three wives. You know, and I made good money, but you know, try taking three different families at three different times to Disneyland. You
know? Wow. It's impossible. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But this whole thing sets the concept of marriage on its ear.
It does.
It just totally disrupts what they have been taught, because divorce was very, very common in those days.
Huh?
And, you know, you get married.
Right.
And the only way you can marry someone else.
Right.
And society still hasn't worked all that out anyway.
No.
About marriage. And I can really see how this would be so hard.
It was.
And I say I'm surprised to read this. So I'd always heard that a lot of the wives didn't get along, and that you were on the lower end of the pecking order, life wasn't very pleasant for you. And so I'm happy to see that these sisters
Well, and that's why I think there's a difference then between, again, Nauvoo polygamy and Utah polygamy, because that's where a lot of those things, you know, I'm going to send my husband off on a mission. He comes back with a bride, you know, and she's younger and prettier than me.
But these sisters never lived in a familial community.
No, they didn't, other than in Utah polygamy, like with Brigham Young or something like that.
On a funny note.
Yes. What, do we need to lighten this thing up a little bit?
Right. So, growing up, my mother constantly talked about polygamy, and she was prepared to live it. This is God's law.
And yeah.
I mean, I heard this frequently growing up. Well, her husband died several years before she did. My dad died. And so she did not do well as a widow. And so she ended up marrying someone else. And what she told me is, oh, yeah, your father's up there. I'm sure he's found somebody else that he likes and would marry. So it's okay if I marry someone else.
Wow. Okay. It works. Hey. All right. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Becky.
Me. First, my father was part of the I grew up being told that my grandfather was called into this president.
Yeah, a lot of times kind of. Do you know what time, when that was? Oh, okay. Oh, 1900, huh? Yeah, it would be secret since that was after the first manifesto.
Well, they were
Mexico. Yeah, that's right. Mexico and Canada. Yeah, we have, you know, maybe in one of our, we might touch on that down the road here. Becky?
I'm just wondering back about all those wives. How did they all know each of them? Were his wife?
That's a really good question. I don't know, because again, that was I think it would have slowly gotten out. Like for instance, in the Emma knew, like I say, about the Huntingtons. Some she knew and some she didn't know. Whether she was talking to others, that's really a good question. I don't know. Certainly they knew later down the road. It was one of those things, yeah. Emma believed some things about Fanny Alger, and she believed that there was an adulterous thing that had happened there. And I don't know if she ever came off that notion, but Oliver had kind of believed that as well. And so when he raised some issues about that, that played a role in driving a wedge between him and Joseph and Kirtland. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right. So let me just show you this. Hopefully, I always do this with a certain amount of trepidation, because sometimes it translates. So just before Joseph is killed, the church is going to issue the second edition of the Doctrine and Covenants. There was the Book of Commandments was the first edition. This is now the Doctrine and Covenants. Here it comes, 1844, in Nauvoo, printed by John Taylor, and awesome. We will get it. I never know if I'm going to get this or not. Okay. At the back of almost the last revelation that was included in the 1844 Doctrine and Covenants was this statement on marriage. Okay. And
what section? That's C1X. What's that in Roman numeral?
110?
Nine.
109. how to do it. Nope, we missed it. There it is. All legal contracts of marriage before a person is baptized, let's see. And fulfilled. Inasmuch as this Church of Christ has been reproached with the crime of fornication and polygamy, we declare and we believe that one man should have but one wife and one woman but one husband, except in the case of death, where either is under the liberty to marry again. So, in other words, a part of that trying to keep a lid on this thing is we're going to try and publish publicly and say we don't endorse polygamy. And technically, in their minds, like, polygamy is something that you do for time, that we're not doing that. This is sealings that are happened for eternity. So technically, this isn't polygamy because these are legally married by heaven and sealed to that purpose. But we're going to put that out there, again, still trying to do this. And again, this sits in the 1844 edition of the Doctrine and Covenants until 1852. And in 1852, they will take this thing out. They will put Section 132 into that next edition. It just gives you the idea. Again, look at the struggle they're having to go through. Now, to Joseph's point, and his particular struggle, I think, was this. On one hand, he believes he's been given a revelation to do this. I need to fulfill this. In fact, the angel is telling me I need to do this. On the other side is what? Emma. And Emma, even in church historian thing, says Emma ran hot and cold on this, and that someday she'd be supportive. Yeah, go ahead and marry the Huntington sisters again. Marry the Huntington sisters, and then change your mind and then say no. Now, it is kind of telling. Part of what helped Emma accept the Huntington sisters was the fact that Emma was also, think about all the time she'd moved and been moved around, and the houses she'd had and the houses she'd lost, and now she's raising kids, and she's also worried about her posterity and her kids. So part of what happens on that day when that you've heard about that, Hiram says to Joseph, how's Emma doing with this? Not good. If you will write down the revelation, I will carry it to her. I will give it to her. And Joseph goes, you don't know Emma like I know Emma. No, I think I can do that. I can sell this thing. Okay. So they will take, it says about 3 hours according to the scribe. It takes about 3 hours to carefully write down Section 132, which he does. Okay, he will then give that to Hiram. Hiram will then carry that to Emma. Emma will read it. It's not very complimentary to Emma at certain points, and she will reject it, and then she will burn it. They did have a copy that was made. That's why we got the copy in Doctrine and Covenants. But part of how she will give some approval, if she's aware of some of these, is that she makes a deal with Joseph, and he deeds her some land on the other side of the Mississippi, over in Zarahemla. So she gets some deed to some property, and it won't make any difference anyway, because when Joseph died, the trustee and trust of the whole church was Emma. So when he dies, she owns the Kirtland Temple, the Nauvoo Temple. She owns just about everything. So she'll have a way to survive. But at that moment, she's her only way to kind of guarantee some of her financial security going forward is that she needs to get some land. Okay. So I feel for Joseph, feeling like this is something that I need to do, but he can't get Emma's support to do it. And I think that, what an incredible battle that had to be. And then he's going to try and then present it to the apostles as they're rolling back from Great Britain. And even after they accept it, it still has to be kept secret because of what might happen. And what might happen is what happened. Joseph Smith was. It was then exposed in the Nauvoo Expositor in April 1844. And he's accused of, from the King Follett Discourse, saying that all people can become gods, and he's practicing spiritual wivery. That's the two things that were out in the Nauvoo Expositor. And in a couple of weeks when we talk about that, I'll bring you a copy of that we have of the Nauvoo Expositor talking about that. Yeah. Plural marriage?
Yes.
Believing, you know, if you're saying that Joseph believed that was a revelation and that he was going to respond to that and that he then acted on that. Yeah. Well, remember, and everything, all on and on and on. We've talked about the fact that Joseph saw this entire church project as an Old Testament church. And that if you read like the first verse of section 132, it says, because you have asked me how it is that Abraham and Jacob took multiple wives and it was counted as righteousness, let me give you the information behind it. So we know that Joseph was like, I'm trying to be like Abraham and I'm trying to be like Moses. They're taking multiple wives. What's the deal? And then he feels like this is what he gets on in section 132. Yeah.
I'm not saying this is official, but one argument for it is that women are inherently more righteous than men.
That was one of the things given, yeah. Yeah, and the thing against celestial polygamy is the fact that it puts the women kind of in an orbit around the guy. You know, there's no equality there. It's like the guy's the center and the women are out here. And that's why it doesn't always feel good. It doesn't make sense based on what we now feel and how it feels to us. Yeah. In Jacob too? Yep. That's the only justification we really have, because unless I raise up righteous seed to me, and I just read something this morning that demographers, people that study that kind of stuff, believe that the church really didn't get that many more kids through polygamy than they would have otherwise. And they've tried to track all of that kind of stuff. But that's the only scriptural thing that we have. Right. Yeah, if it was about raising up a righteous seed, and that's why for him, I think it was very much about sealing people and creating exaltation for the eternities than it was about what's going to happen in this life. It was about exalting my friends.
I'd like to know if anybody's willing to do it by a raise of hand. Who is descended?
Oh. Yeah, Jeff. Yeah, we're here, right? So it has come down. It has come down through the line. Now the last thing that I want to finish up with here, guys, is that how did, especially when we get into Utah, how did especially the women see polygamy? And it's really easy to see how they framed it, and that they saw it. And I read it over and over and over. They just simply saw it as an Abrahamic test. It's an Abrahamic test. It doesn't make sense to us. It's painful for us. This thing is hard. And yet at the same time, they saw it as an Abrahamic test of obedience on level with Abraham. That's how they viewed it.
Yeah. Given that, it's always fascinating. My understanding is even when it was known that you practiced, it was still
Yeah. Well, and in some ways, when I've looked at, I think it is interesting. Guys, just in terms of practicality, the where I can see that this might have had some utility in this is that when I think about, okay. Teacher, speculation. Okay. That when the church moves out to Utah and it's isolated until the railroad comes through in 1869, Utah is pretty isolated. And you read these stories about widows and women that were out there in isolated settings, and in some ways plural marriage was a way for them to be able to develop families and have their homes taken care of and stuff. I can see some utility in that. Outside of that, I have a hard time. You know, I do, guys. I'm not making any bones about it. Yeah.
So, like when Abraham had four wives, at least.
Yeah.
They kind of all lived together.
Except for Hagar, they got kicked out into the woods.
Well,
okay. Yeah, there was Hagar.
Yeah, I guess it's Jacob that had four wives.
That he kind of kept together, yes. Because he got duped.
A lot of these relationships, the husband had three wives, and the wives each had their own house.
Yeah.
And I mean, the dynamic to me would be totally different if you had multiple wives in multiple houses compared to multiple wives living in one house.
Like the lion house where they've got their own.
As a team or as a rolling cat fight.
Yeah, the fact that they had their separate houses and were maintained but were getting some financial support from husbands. In some cases they did. In some cases, they're not. You know, and so I say in on the ground, boots on the ground, this was a really hard thing. That's why I'm glad we're not going to go back to this very much. But yeah.
The way that I can't speak for sure about all the guidelines now, but 15 years ago, it was quite an ordeal. The ceiling was not taken lightly, but yet we wanted. I think we had to have many interviews. The bishop had to call the ex-spouses to make sure that it was a financial thing. They had something to say they were minor children. Child support and their children. But it was very serious. We had to write letters and all, and it just was a packet that got sent eventually to our bishop, each of our prospective bishops and state presidents. And we were told you'll hear when they're ready to tell you.
How long did it take?
It didn't take us very long.
It's generally about 2 weeks, I think, these days.
But that's what we were told. Don't keep asking us. It'll happen. And to me, it was not easy to have to go through all that. But it says to me that the ceiling, how important the ceiling is, and that the Lord does not take it.
Absolutely.
And this is what kind of bothers me about this. They were just deciding, you know, and I think it had to evolve because the most important thing for us was making sure that everything was right, that we could be sealed to each other. And some of it was very hard. You have to sit with your state president and he says, okay, tell me all about your marriage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's just like taking part of your stomach out. And it was painful. It was very painful for me.
Did they contact any of your former bishops?
I don't know. Did you get it? No.
No.
Yes, you were. No, but they did contact the bishops.
Okay.
I mean, but my point is, I feel very, and when you went to the temple to be sealed, yes, we had an appointment, but we had to have all the paperwork. And so, to me, it says how important, really the most important thing is the sealing.
Yeah.
And this way, nobody's feeling everybody had a chance. And I also feel that whoever is in charge of the office of this, I'm concerned.
Can you imagine? Yeah, from all over the world. Yeah, I can't either. Yeah, it'd be a hard. I know you're talking about tender stuff, and yet at the same time, so we do as much as we can here, and then I guess the last thing I would put on this is, and I just read a statement from Elder Oaks, President Oaks, who said, "And who knows what the eternity looks like?" You know, we're doing our best we can in this life, and then when we start forming all those relationships, who knows what the eternities then look like? We have no idea, and I try and say that a lot. Yeah.
The one thing we can let go of is the old saw that you can't a man couldn't enter into a polygamous union unless he had the permission of his wife.
Can we do that?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, or that polygamy is going to be required into the eternities, which was one of those things in the, because Orson Pratt is going to, at the end of this, Orson Pratt is going to do some, in late 1850s, is going to have some real celebrated arguments with prominent preachers in the tabernacle defending polygamy, and it's going to be well documented in a variety of places. He becomes a big advocate, and part of that was going to be included, that at that point, yes, it's an Abrahamic test, but yes, polygamy is going to be part and parcel of celestial kingdom, and this is what it requires, you know, and section 132 kind of hints at that. Everybody's going to have to be living this. And those are things that I think we're kind of moving past beyond that. But we don't know what that looks like. So anyway, did we get through this? You guys are troopers, man. Yeah, I know. Yeah, but we can go a little faster through Utah. This to me is the harder part, and this is the one that has more questions than it has answers, and it's the one that I'm probably most uncomfortable with in our church history is polygamy just in general. So, all right, any final comments? Anybody else want to muddy the waters before we get finished here? Sue?
One question. I was always told that not just everybody could practice it, that they had to be called to practice it. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, as you got into Utah and they were starting to, like, church handbook kind of stuff, who's going to do it and who can't. So you're going to be called to do it, and then you're going to start doing it. And sometimes church leaders were involved in saying, you need to go ahead and practice this. But then it sort of gets past that a little bit. Again, when you get missionaries going off and they come back with young brides, you know, and surprise their wives at home, even though section 132 says you got to get their permission. Well, they weren't doing that on a regular basis. That's why I say it gets messy after a while, and I don't think the practice of it was done. It became increasingly hard. Maybe that's the best way to say it. Yeah.
I think it's important to recognize that this world we live in is messy.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we want to know how things work in the eternity. And a lot of times we come up with a story about how they work, and some of those stories might be right, a few. But the thing to remember is that however it works in the eternities is going to be the
joyous.
Right way. It's going to be the
yes.
right way. It's
Thank you.
Be right.
That's, yes.
And so the fact that we don't understand what right is going to be, and we can't necessarily presuppose how God's worked it out, but we can know that he's going to do it right.
I think that's it. And maybe that's the best note to end on. Because, when I've got people that come into my office and they're struggling either with marriages or divorces or sealings or they have gay kids or whatever it is, and we're trying to picture what the eternities look like. I've said this before, guys. I know two things about the eternities. Only two things. One, in the eternities, we will be more joyful and more happy than we have any comprehension in this life. That exaltation is beyond our greatest ability as humans to understand how joyful and happy that is. Number two, see number one. Because we have no knowledge or understanding what that will look like and how that is structured. That's why when people try saying, this is what it's going to look like in the celestial kingdom, I'll go, no, you don't. You don't know. All you know is we're going to be joyful, we're going to be happy, and we don't know what it looks like, period. So how about we just do the best we can in this life and go from there? So anyway, bear you my testimony that, again, we have two things going on always. That the gospel of Jesus Christ is the saving power in our life. It is, we worship the Savior, and it is by His name and His power that we become exalted. Number two, the church is flawed. Leaders are flawed. We struggle. We do the best we can. We're inspired, but we make changes as we get more knowledge and understanding. But it administers the gospel. But at the end of the day, we don't worship Joseph Smith. We don't worship Brigham Young. We don't worship President Nelson. We worship the Savior. And ultimately, our eyes are on Him, and all of us struggle. So I think we give some grace to these guys making good decisions and struggling decisions, and love them as the inspired leaders that they were, with all their flaws and warts. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. That said, I'm thinking that for next week, kind of looking at Joseph's run for president and the Council of 50. We got new documents on what the Council of 50 was and what they were trying to do, just a few minutes. Unless you have anything, you bought anything on the Council of 50? Are there any documents out there? Okay.
We're not going to be here.
Oh, you're going to miss out on that part. Okay, I can tell you the good stuff then. Well, thank you. Thank you.
We're going down to get married again.
Yeah, because Hinckley told us to. Yeah, that would work well. All right. Dee, could you give us a closing prayer? And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.